From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. This is just one segment of the show. Each weekday, Brian and his guests take on the topics of the day, and you can hear all of these conversations on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Of what possible use are goosebumps? Why do we blush, yawn, or hiccup? Well, on today's edition of Please Explain, we're going to address these and other intriguing medical mysteries. And joining me now are John Krakauer, an assistant professor of neurology in the Division of Stroke and Critical Care at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Robert Provine, professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's one of the world's leading authorities on yawning, and he is the author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation, which is published by Viking. Welcome to my show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Dr. Provine, I'm going to do something that may be daring and begin this program with a question about yawning. Why do humans yawn? Do we really know?
Well, that's a tough one. We yawn for a lot of different reasons. And for that reason, it's hard to come through with a straight answer. But evasive, I'll tell you what a variety of them are. We yawn most just after we wake up in the morning, but we also yawn a lot just before going to bed. We really do yawn more when we're bored, but we also sometimes yawn when we're anxious. For example, a concert violinist getting ready to go out on the stage, or an Olympic athlete before their big event, they may yawn. And also something that our listeners may have picked up on is simply hearing people talking about yawning or thinking about yawning will trigger yawns. So yawns are highly contagious.
And we can't stop them, can we? You can clench your teeth, but people will notice those muscles working in the back of your jaw.
Yeah, once a yawn gets underway, it goes to completion. It's performed with what students of animal behavior call typical intensity. A yawn is an all-or-nothing event. So once it gets underway, you can't stifle it.
Is it true that we yawn in the womb?
Yes, yawning occurs before birth. It occurs toward the end of the first trimester of prenatal development. So yawning and also stretching occur very early on.
Are they related?
Yes, they are.
I remember being told that yawning was a way of getting yourself to breathe deeply or getting more oxygen to your brain.
A yawn does involve a deep breath. However, one of the most common pieces of folklore about yawning, that we yawn to give ourselves more oxygen or to get rid of excess CO2, hasn't worked out. And the only lab test of this, I found that people don't yawn more when you give them extra CO2, and they don't yawn less when they breathe 100% oxygen.
Dr. Krakauer, how much is understood about what's happening in the brain when we yawn?
Very little, I think. I mean, sometimes we can get ideas about what part of the brain is important for some of these funny events by knowing what happens when you get lesioned. And we certainly, in stroke patients, will see lots of yawning in patients who have brainstem strokes, for example. So it suggests that it's a reflex mediated at the brainstem level. But I don't think that there's any evidence that higher brain centers are important. On the other hand, the fact that boredom can trigger it makes you wonder whether there's some higher level control on those reflexes, or whether, you know, I was thinking to myself about boredom, whether boredom simply means that there's not that much reason to be awake, and so you might as well be asleep. And then I was going to ask Dr. Provine if it is true that yawning is a way of sort of triggering arousal and keeping yourself awake, so that maybe when you're bored you might fall asleep and therefore you yawn to trigger your ability to stay awake.
A way of resetting?
Yes, a resetting mechanism.
Well, I think that's part of the story, because while we yawn before we go to bed and we yawn we start to get drowsy, people also yawn sometimes when they're stressed or anxious, and you also yawn after waking in the morning. You also yawn when you see other people yawn or simply think about yawning. Or people hearing us talking about yawning right now are probably going to be thinking about yawning and will yawn. This discussion is triggering a wave of yawning in the audience. And this suggests that there are higher centers that can influence it. But while Dr. Krakauer has said, you know, we are dealing with some ancient brainstem mechanisms. The antiquity of these mechanisms is suggested by the fact that most animals with backbones yawn. You know, alligators do it, snakes do it, birds do it, as well as human beings do it. And also, its early development prenatally are all consistent with we're dealing with one of the most ancient vertebrate behaviors.
Now, you said earlier that it's related to stretching. In what way?
Well, when you stretch, you usually yawn. But you don't yawn, typically don't stretch when you yawn. You know, for example, you wake up in the morning, you see people yawn and stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Late in the evening, you find people yawning, but they don't stretch. So this suggests that stretching and yawning are coupled, where stretching drives yawning, but yawning doesn't drive stretching. You'll see this in your pet dogs or cats. When they wake up from their slumber, they'll often stretch and yawn.
Dr. Krakauer, we talked about yawning, inducing yawning. Can it serve some social purpose?
Yawning?
Yes.
I don't really know if I'm qualified to comment on that.
Dr. Provine?
But I do think one thing I wanted to mention just about the stretching, with one of the remarkable phenomena we will see in patients who have become paralyzed from a stroke, you can ask them to lift their arm and they are completely unable to do so. And yet when they start yawning, their arm will suddenly lift up, which is very fascinating. It suggests that whatever the mechanism triggering the yawning in the brainstem also allows you to bypass motor pathways from the brain down to the brainstem, and there must be some brainstem pathways that are left intact. So the patients are very surprised at this arm that they've never been able to move. They start to yawn, and up goes their arm. So in that case, I would suggest that the yawning can drive the moving.
Is there a way of grouping some of these behaviors, yawning, blushing, sweating, goosebumps, and so on, together to help us understand them? Is this something about the way the brain works?
I do believe. I think I don't know about yawning. I think sweating, itching, tickling, hair standing up on end are all emotionally driven manifestations of our autonomic nervous system.
Shivering
as well, yes, shivering as well. I mean, I think people can group them under the rubric of the function of the autonomic nervous system. In other words, there are two nervous systems in a way. There's the sort of nervous system that is a voluntary nervous system controlling muscles for speech, for movement, and the sensory inputs to control that output. And then there's the autonomic nervous system, you know, the automatic nervous system that's controlling blood vessel diameter, controlling the constriction of your pupil, controlling your breathing patterns, your heartbeat.
That would lead to blushing as well.
Blushing as well. And you can imagine, of course, that you would not want to be having to voluntarily control your digestive sphincters, control your heartbeat. You wouldn't be able to concentrate on anything. So there's an enormous amount of stuff going on in the background with motor and sensory inputs, which are much more automatic. And that system seems to be very tied into your emotional state and can therefore manifest itself in unwanted ways, even though most of the time that automatic system is, of course, crucial to life.
Well, how crucial, Dr. Provine, can goosebumps be? We get them in all sorts of different reasons. There can be a physical reason. We suddenly are chilled. There are emotional responses to excitement or fear, and I have no idea why we need this. Would Darwin be able to explain?
Well, he does a very good job of either explaining or determining what's important. And first of all, I think when we're looking at these ancient behaviors, usually behaviors of, you know, that are called instinctive, they're shared by all members of our species, and they're genetically determined. We don't learn them during our lifespans. But we're dealing with unconsciously controlled behavior that are rather crude. In the case of, for example, the piloerection, you know, this would be the same kind of behavior you would see of a cat, for example, perking up its hair to make itself look bigger or more fearsome if it's frightened.
Chimps do that, too.
Yeah. It's like we're not a completely naked ape, but our hairs are short and blonder. In fact, we may be hairier than chimps in terms of hairs per square inch.
So goosebumps are really just hair standing up on end? It's similar to the hairs on the back of our neck standing up when we're afraid?
Or porcupines. Also, it's associated with, you know, puffing up the fur that would increase warmth.
Mm. Now, Dr. Krakauer, do you have any idea why these things happen? Why this... this is the first time I'm hearing the word piloerection, but I realize it's perfectly okay. The FCC will not get upset. That means hair standing up.
Yes.
Is this something that comes out of the brain stem or the higher brain?
Well, it can happen at the spinal cord level as well. In other words, you can have it as a reflex, but it can. And I think an important thing to know is that reflexes, although they can happen at low levels of the neuroanatomical axis, are amenable to control from higher centers. For example, there are forms of seizures where the sole manifestation of temporal lobe seizures can be getting goosebumps. And so we know these seizures are originating up in cortex, in temporal lobe cortex. So it is clear that one can drive these quite low-level reflexes from higher centers.
You could create goosebumps by simply touching somebody lightly on the neck or along the spine.
Right. So it means that you can go from a local stimulus to a spreading output, and that probably requires central nervous system processing. But I think the general theme here is you have processes which are important, for example, in thermoregulation. Like Dr. Provine said, and which are happening at a low reflex level, and yet they are, at the emotional level, amenable to regulation from higher centers to be used for another reason, for example, fear, or for making yourself look bigger than you are, even though the original reflex may have been there for another reason, thermoregulation.
Dr. Provine, does that apply to blushing as well? Because that's usually the result of embarrassment. So there's an emotional thing, but we have a physical... a way of expressing it.
Yeah, well, there we would be dealing with capillary dilation. The blood vessels just under the skin are going to be dilating. But that has an important social component. So while it would be involved in thermoregulation, regulating, you know, body temperature, skin temperature, it's a very social kind of thing. For example, a person's not going to blush in isolation. But they would blush in the presence of another person. In fact, one of the ways of enhancing the blushing would be call attention to the blushing of the blusher.
Mm-hmm.
And that will emphasize it even more.
But some people blush imperceptibly because of skin color. So why would that, what purpose would that serve?
Well, this has been a source of some mystery since the time of Darwin or before. I can't be of much help there.
I think there's been some interesting about blushing. I mean, one of the interesting things about it is that no one really knows the mechanism. It's actually thought to perhaps be due to dilatation of veins rather than of arteries, and veins usually aren't under much sympathetic control. But people have actually removed people's veins, part of their facial vein, after surgery. If they've had to have some sort of surgery and you get a bit of vein and you can start applying chemicals to it. And surprisingly, parts of the facial vein can actually respond to transmitters that are released by your autonomic nervous system, whereas, if, for example, your jugular vein doesn't. Again, it seems to be this sympathetic nervous response, and there's been some fascinating work apparently on camels where their facial vein can be used to cool the brain.
And camels do blush, and so do Pharaoh hounds, I gather, the only dogs that blush, But it can't be out of embarrassment.
No, I think it's. I think again, it's the feeling there is the camel's not blushing because it's embarrassed. I think the camel is blushing because they're thinking it may have some thermoregulatory role.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these regulatory reflexes get coerced into be using for emotional reasons. It's another one of those dual mechanisms.
Has anybody done studies on whether people blush when they're talking on the phone?
I don't know.
That would be an interesting proposition because blushing is enhanced by the presence of another person or someone calling attention to blushing. Mm. But
they could say, I'm sure you're blushing right now, and you could still blush even though you're not seen.
Yeah, that would be an interesting experiment, including looking at blushing in congenitally blind people.
And also whether the differences in the way people blush is due to, you know, the different innovations of their facial veins, or whether some people just don't get as embarrassed as others. I'm sure those are both equally true. So a non-blusher might just be somebody who has no shame.
Well, we have no shame here. We're going to take a little break and then come back with you in a little while. I hope you'll stay with us. My guests are John Krakauer, Assistant Professor of Neurology in the Division of Stroke and Critical Care at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Robert Provine, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's the author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation, which is published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Please Explain Today, talking to Drs. Provine and Dr. Krakauer about these involuntary things that happen to us, like blushing, hiccuping, goosebumps, and the like. Dr. Krakauer, you were saying earlier, and I wasn't exactly sure of the complete concept, that there's a superimposition of the brain stem on the higher brain that leads to some of these involuntary actions?
I was sort of saying the reverse, is that there are brain stem and spinal cord reflexes which may have one function, for example, temperature regulation, but that these simpler circuits are amenable to modification by the brain descending down onto those circuits. So we see a complex interplay between a simple circuit and an emotional overlay by the brain, and in that way the circuit ends up perhaps even being used or manifesting for reasons which are other than what it was originally intended for.
So do we get into trouble when we try to figure out what evolutionary purpose some of these might serve?
Trouble. I don't think we get into trouble. I think
sometimes we get confused.
I think it's just one has to be careful not to tell a just-so story. In other words, one can come up with all sorts of absurd explanations. But I think if one has a notion of the mechanism of these circuits, one can come up with some plausible explanations as to what they might be doing and then how they've gone awry.
But for example, Dr. Provine, what evolutionary purpose might tickling serve or have served in the past?
Well, that's an intriguing one. But I'd like to mention something about yawning before we move on. There's a case of exactly what Dr. Krakauer was talking about the relationship between the upper and the higher. We have a very ancient brainstem mechanism, but you can also trigger yawning by simply thinking about it or talking about it or reading about it, which are clearly higher cognitive processes. And the function of yawning, for example, it's easy to talk about the act itself, which is what I prefer to do. But if you're looking for its function, it looks like it probably has several. You yawn just after waking, just before bedtime. You yawn when you're bored, but sometimes you also yawn when you're anxious. So what you can say all these things have in common is a transition. And so yawning may very well facilitate the transition, but it may be a number of different kind of transitions. In regard to the issue of tickle, there is an intriguing interaction between a rather basic reflex-like activity and something that's more sophisticated and social. One of the most intriguing places to start a consideration of tickle is the finding you can't tickle yourself. You can give yourself a knee-jerk reflex, but you can't tickle yourself.
And some people are not ticklish. I'm not ticklish. I was when I was younger. And I don't know, somewhere down the line, I just seem to have willed myself out of being ticklish. And now I can't be ticklish whether I want to be or not.
Well, actually, that's an empirical issue. And more men than women say that they're not ticklish. But when put to the test, men and women seem to be equally ticklish.
Well, I promise you I'm not ticklish.
Well, we'll have to, you're far away.
Bring in the feathers.
We'll have to take your word for that. But if you look, if you ask the question, who tickles whom, you come up with some intriguing things. In the world of the social sciences, where you have huge sample sizes in research and often tiny effects, you have huge effects in the world of tickle. For example, if you ask who you tickle, you overwhelmingly tickle an individual of the opposite sex. This is aside from rough and tumble play with parents with the kids in the homes and so on. But if you look at adults and you ask the question, who did you tickle most recently or who tickled you, it's going to be an individual of the opposite sex. It's like around 10 to 1 or perhaps more. And another intriguing thing is even amongst people who are confirmed tickle haters, I think they have this notion of some evil older brother holding them down and tickling them until they couldn't breathe. But you forget that the give and take of tickle battles is also plays itself out in sex play. So the tickle hater may think, well, gee, it's not so bad if you think about it that way. Also in tickle, you have the roots of social play. For example, when a person's tickled, they may try to fend away the hand of the tickler and escape, but often come back for seconds or counterattack. And this give and take is a kind of neurologically programmed social action. So whether you're looking at squirrels frolicking around the yard, you know, tumbling around and then go racing off one, chasing another up the tree and so on, they're bound together in the give and take of a social relationship. And who would have guessed it? So when you start to look at the fine details of these things, you often find something much more exciting and interesting than you would have anticipated.
Dr. Krakauer, do we know if other animals are ticklish?
Well, again, the tickling question, I think, has two flavors. One, I think, which I'll talk about in a minute, is this notion of why you can't tickle yourself, which I think there's now some neural understanding of why that is. But the first one is that tickling is, you know, until very recently was thought to be a form of pain. It was mediated by similar fibers that mediate pain. And, you know, you could, if you wanted to tell a silly evolutionary story, you could imagine that, you know, you want to be able to tell when a spider is running up your arm, for example. That certainly tickles. And you want to detect it. So why we have fibers in our skin that are especially sensitive to tickle and itch rather than pain, I don't think can be explained at the high levels of social interaction. But again, that's an example of how a sensation at a low level was incorporated into higher level behaviors. As to the notion as to why you can never tickle yourself as pleasurably as when you're tickled by others, it seems there's been a very intriguing experiment was done in England where they had people tickle themselves with a robot. And what they could do is either the robot would tickle you without your knowing when you would be tickled, or you could activate the robot, but there would be a delay between when you activated the robot and when the robot tickled you. And what was fascinating is as the delay increased between when you activated the robot to tickle you and the robot tickled you, the more pleasurable the tickle became. And so it led to this idea that there's a system that exists all the way down to lower animals, which is that if you can anticipate the sensory consequences of what you're about to do, you suppress it. Whereas if you can't anticipate the sensory consequences of what's coming in terms of very good timing, it activates more completely. And they actually did a brain imaging study of tickling. And they showed that when you tickled yourself, or when the gap between the robot tickle and your activation was done, the brain activated less than when the tickle came at a delay or unexpectedly. And so the theory is that you cancel out actively the anticipated consequences when you're responsible, but that doesn't happen when someone else tickles you. So there's been some fascinating brain work now on why you cannot tickle yourself.
I want to take some calls in just a moment. Our number here is 212-267-WNYC. That's 267-9692.
Yeah, can I chime in on the tickle story?
Of course, and then I'd like to know what you think about hiccups and shivers, and if we can do them in short order.
Okay. As Dr. Krakauer said, actually, the English seem to be the champion of the tickle mechanism area. I think Weisskrantz at Oxford had first done some work with a mechanical device, then more recently Sarah Jane
Blakemore
with the computer device he was just talking about, that have shown that basically the nervous system is canceling out self-produced stimulation. In fact, it's a good thing that happens, or otherwise we'd be going through our life in a giant chain reaction of goosing response. Okay, that would be most distressing.
I think so.
At a more basic level, looking at the issue of tickle, you know, which means you have to be tickled by something not self, gives us an insight into what the mechanism of self is. And this is a line of work I've been pursuing recently, in that it gives us a way of looking at the neurological foundation of something social. Well, most social investigators have typically neglected the neurological. But if you ask what tickles you and what doesn't, you're getting at the issue of what's self and not self. So you're starting to deal with a very fundamental issue of defining the neurological basis of self and other.
Because you could ask why it is, you know, that a lobster doesn't turn around to eat its own tail. I mean, there must be some, even at a low level, some difference between self and inside and outside that is probably the basis for self at a higher level. And in fact, the autonomic nervous system we're talking about seems to be focused mainly on sensations coming from the inside, whereas the non-autonomic nervous system is about the outside. So I completely agree that one can build fascinating models of self from these relatively easy, low-level models.
Is that why primates tend to tickle each other? Anybody who's visited the zoo has seen baby gorillas tickle each other as part of their play.
Well, also, virtually all mammals, you know, are animals known for social relationships and play, you know, but not reptiles, typically. But with mammals, you start to see you see play, you see a lot of these interactions, these racing around, and I'm certain that you would see something akin to what we experience, and perhaps even laughter. In fact, tickle is a very deep and important act that provides insights into many other things. I think it deserves more than its previous footnote status.
Yeah.
In fact, tickle even provides insights into where laughter comes from. So if you look at tickle in chimpanzees, something that I'd looked at, you find that the human ha-ha-ha of laughter really had its origin in the pant, 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 the labored breathing of rough-and-tumble play in chimpanzees. So when one chimp is tickling another and they're chasing each other around, they make their own chimp laughter sound, which is, if you can pardon me, as a fellow chimpanzee, I'll make the sound. That panting sound, which is chimp laughter, became ha-ha-ha. And in fact, that transition indicates not only the difference between human and chimpanzee laughter, but why we talk and they can't. It's basically chimps don't have sufficient control over breathing to make the complicated sound of human laughter, and neither can they speak.
Is hiccuping connected to this? Because sometimes when people laugh a lot, they wind up getting the hiccups.
Well, Well, I think that's probably, and Dr. Provine might disagree, I think that may well be because maybe when you're laughing hard, you start to do a lot of inspiration, and its hiccups seem to occur more when you're in the inspiratory phase.
Mm-hmm. But I always was told that it was because of some spasm of the diaphragm, but you say that's not true.
Well, no. The diaphragm is the major inspiratory muscle, and the phrenic nerve, which innervates the diaphragm, can be irritated. It has a sensory and a motor component, and certainly I, for example, will get the hiccups every time I have spicy food. I mean, we're almost 100% predictable that I'll get the hiccups, and I'm assuming that's due to some sort of esophageal irritation by the spicy food, which in itself then leads to irritation of the phrenic nerve that innervates the diaphragm. So that's just the mechanism of hiccups rather than what originates it.
What about shivers?
Shivering is entirely different. I think shivering is a triggered, temperature-triggered muscle spasm to try and prevent the body from cooling down. In other words, it's when we, for example, try and cool patients in the critical care unit for reasons of controlling their fever or trying to prevent damage to the brain by high temperatures, we will always trigger intense shivering as the body tries through muscle contraction to maintain body warmth. But again, that's quite a low-level reflex response. Whereas hiccups, we don't really have any idea what hiccups, why we have them. I mean, the most intriguing idea that I've ever heard is that it's actually rather like what Dr. Provine was saying about reptiles versus mammals, is that the theory is that it's a remnant of what happens in frogs and tadpoles, where a gill breathing mechanism has remained in our brainstem and competes sometimes with our more advanced ventilatory breathing mechanism. And every now and then, this little tadpole variant reveals itself and we get the hiccups. So that's very intriguing that we have this reptile brainstem, or should I say amphibian brainstem, competing with more later versions.
But what's interesting to me is that we really don't know completely about any of these very common experiences. The New York Times recently had an article on the female orgasm, and there are competing theories.
Well, there's a whole book that's just been written on it, yes.
And people have been calling in to wonder about male erections, for example, or I guess the female and orgasms as well. Are these totally different, or are these all part of the same thing we've been discussing?
I think it's not right to say they're all part of the same thing. The only way it would be true would be to say that there's an enormous amount going on in the body that we are not conscious of. And I think the more useful notion of the unconscious today would be, rather than thinking of it in a Freudian sense, would be to accept that a large percentage of the computational processes being carried out by our nervous system are being done without us being consciously aware of them, nor having voluntary control over them. And all these fragments that we're describing today are just simply highlighting how much is going on without us being aware of it. And you could argue that animals, most animals, cats, dogs, reptiles, are doing everything in their lives without being aware in the way that we are. And so all of animal behavior is sort of automatic. It's only when you get to higher primates and humans that we have this sudden desire to be aware of what all these things are for. In fact, my mother, when she knew I was doing this today, said, "Oh, you're just talking about those few things that we have left that we have no control over." And that was very interesting, because it was this idea that there are these little things and everything else we have awareness of and control of. But in fact, the converse is true.
Yeah, I agree with that point. I think we have this illusion that we are conscious, rational creatures in full voluntary control of all that we do. And I think that's in large part an illusion. For example, we're not aware of our own state of unconsciousness. For example, when you're not paying attention, you're not conscious of unconsciousness. and we may not be conscious most of the time. And also, we may have an illusion of conscious control. For example, in my studies of laughter, I found that people are a very unreliable reporter on their own state. For example, laughter is not under conscious control. In certain social circumstances, people simply laugh. And if you ask them why they did that, they might say, I laughed because I was nervous, I laughed to put someone at ease. But if you ask someone to laugh voluntarily, they'll tell you, well, I can't laugh just because you ask me. And this got me thinking about the generality of this issue. Is basically we go through life constructing these sort of imaginary scripts. In neurology, they call them confabulations. So just as a brain-damaged person may confabulate, make up stories that to provide some sort of rational continuity in what they're doing, we un-brain-damaged individuals also go through life providing these kind of confabulations to provide a rational script for what's in large part irrational and unconscious.
As some of the listeners who've called in have suggested, a woman said that she blushes even when she's not embarrassed, but just when she gets any attention. But that's irrational, but I guess it's based on some kind of a psychological need.
But the confabulation idea is, I think I completely agree with that notion of confabulation. In fact, I was thinking one day of trying to write a book about confabulation, and then to my chagrin, a book has just recently been published, the first ever, I believe, on that topic. But I think the point of confabulation, Dr. Provine, if I understand you correctly, people can be made to laugh, and then after the fact will come up for a reason for it. Isn't that basically the point?
Yeah, that's why, I think certainly we must admire the contributions of philosophers over the ages. For example, their contribution to describing laughter, for example, is rather limited because it's really not subjective to rational introspective analysis.
But many things like anger, I mean, we all know that around the time of menstruation, nerves can be frayed and women can be more irritable, and that's probably very biological, and yet one will always find a reason about what's happening circumstantially to explain the anger, even though the threshold for anger has been changed for completely non-rational reasons. And I think there are many cases of patients coming up with explanations for what they're doing. I've had patients tell me that they're not at the hospital, and you ask them why, and they'll say they've been kidnapped and they've been moved into a building that's different from their own, and they'll come up with remarkable confabulations that have nothing to do with what's going on around them. And I think it's absolutely correct that we do that all the time. We think we're in control when, in fact, we're not. And these little fragments we're talking about today are the tip of the iceberg.
Gentlemen,
also, there's a tendency to confuse intelligent behavior with conscious behavior.
Yes.
And you look at social insects such as ants, such as termites, such as bees. They can do some rather remarkable things. They certainly don't have consciousness, or certainly not a consciousness as we appreciate it. And yet, we typically confuse these two things. So basically, I think we're going through life making up these confabulations, these imaginary scripts to give order and rationality to the unconscious and irrational.
And that's a wonderful way.
Every time we become aware that we may be guilty of this is when we find the few things we can't explain away, like hiccups and blushing and unwanted sweating and things like that.
And what a wonderful ending to a segment called Please Explain. My great thanks to both of you. John Krakauer, Assistant Professor of Neurology in the Division of Stroke and Critical Care at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Robert Provine, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. It's been a lot of fun for me. I hope it's been as enjoyable for you.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.